Hi, Anna.
Hello, Rich. How are you?
Good. How's it going?
Pretty well. I actually want to say that we're taping this on Friday. It won't be posted till Monday, so I don't want this to be accepted as proof of life should anything happen in DC's snowpocalypse.
That's right. This will be like someone should bury this, right? And
yes.
when you guys dig out, this will be like a time capsule, what it was like right at the beginning of the storm.
That's right. It'll be studied by future generations.
I'm actually from Washington, and I love snow, so I loved the big deal that was made over it when I was growing up. And I remember actually one of my fondest childhood memories was of a blizzard. And, I'd go to bed at night when there was a forecast of snow and tingling with anticipation, barely able to sleep. And so often I'd wake up and there'd be no snow whatsoever. But this one time, it was an epic blizzard. There's already a foot of snow on the ground, and then there's actually thunder during the morning, and it snowed another foot in an hour.
That's
and
amazing.
I was just transported with joy.
That is amazing. We're going to have to stop talking about this in terms of politics, but it's supposed to get 30 inches today, so it'll be exciting no matter
I'm
what.
I'm very jealous.
The dogs will be thrilled. So you are, you can introduce yourself.
Oh, Rich Lowry, editor of National Review.
And I am Anna Marie Cox, and right now I'm unemployed. But I hope that changes soon. And I think I can still be called an analyst.
Well, at least you're not in that discouraged category.
No,
of
I have
people who aren't.
Do you
want
to start off with
who make the unemployment rate look better?
Right. We didn't put that on our list of things to talk about, but that is very relevant to me, which is the jobless numbers that came out today, Friday. And yes, they were slightly better, but that has to do with people like my husband would be. If he didn't get some good news, he got some good news yesterday. But we're,
oh, good.
And so he would be discouraged and might have dropped off the rolls. What do you think? I mean, that's obviously, like, I always think that's obviously Obama's biggest problem right now. Is just people see that we are not doing well.
Yeah, I think it's a major contributing factor, obviously. But I worry a little bit, coming at this from the opposite end, that conservatives are going to overplay their hands assuming that the economy is going to be in the crapper for the duration, because I think it's a great engine, the American economy. It's inevitably going to recover.
The fundamentals of our economy are strong.
Well, yeah, exactly. That was our line in 08. We're sticking with it, okay?
And actually what's sad about that is, like, I know what you mean, and I know actually what McCain meant as well. And that's what you're talking about, is that it's fundamentally going to – it will recover.
Yeah, well, I mean, you already see we're losing jobs still, but at a much reduced rate. 5.7% growth in the fourth quarter is a very good sign. So, and, you know, the Federal Reserve has pumped countless billions upon billions of liquidity into the economy. It's going to recover. Now, whether it's sustainable over the long run or whether it's been wise to pump so much money in, that's another question. But if Republicans are counting on this sort of economic mood holding for the duration, I think that's a mistake.
Really? Because I was thinking, and I think the thinking in the White House is that the real threat for this year and the midterms is going to be that Americans are so manifestly frustrated with the economy. So you think that it might not even work for 2010, or are you thinking that's just 2012 is when the economy will stop being?
I just, seeming as though, one, you're invested in the failure of the economy is a bad thing, and two, throwing an argument out there that is dependent on the economy staying soft or weak, you know, throughout the next year, I think is foolish, because it's likely to get stronger over the course of the next year. So you can just overplay your hand on this. You know, we saw it in 1993 when the economy had come out of recession, but it was still weak and it was hurting Clinton. And Republicans just said his tax increase was going to basically create, you know, a second depression.
Right.
And actually, you know, I disagreed with the tax increase. I think it was foolish. But the economy recovered anyway.
And we could see something very much like that with, like, the second stimulus bill and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, because the economy, as George Will likes to point out, the American economy always recovers, unless you really make catastrophic mistakes of the sort we made during the Depression. But all that said, I think the Obama economic policies are a huge mistake. I think the budget, which is something I know we have on our queue to talk about here, is a huge mistake. And I've been sort of appalled at the blame shifting on the budget, because he makes it sound as though he has a soundbite now about, you know, it was tax cuts we didn't pay for, it was two wars we didn't pay for, it was a prescription drug benefit that we didn't pay for, all of which was true,
mm-hmm.
but all of which are not the fundamental driver of the budget picture now. In 2007, I believe the budget deficit was $160 billion, which, you know, would be nirvana if we had it now. And the budget picture got so much worse because of the recession, which I would argue is not Bush's or Obama's fault, and all the recovery efforts. So
wait,
it's unfair to blame Bush.
Okay, go ahead. It's unfair to blame Bush.
Yeah.
Well, I think, but what you just said is you do think the economy is going to recover, and I think their argument that a Democrat would make, and I'm going to make, is that it has to do in part with our recovery efforts and with the efforts that the Obama administration has made. So how can that be a mistake?
Well, two things. I think TARP was necessary,
right.
And I think it saved the financial system. And I think Obama gets Bush kind of coming and going on this, because Obama takes credit for saving the financial system when actually it was this initiative that Bush undertook that was very obviously ideological, uncongenial for him,
right.
And difficult to do, but he stepped to the plate and did it. And then he'll blame Bush for the deficit. So he'll take credit, Obama will take credit for TARP when it supposedly saved the financial system, but then he'll blame Bush for the spending and the deficit spending that were part of TARP.
Right.
So it's either you support it and thought it was a good idea or you don't. So he sort of gets Bush coming and going there. But I think that was necessary, and the big banks have mostly paid it all back. So it's worked rather well in that regard. And I think the Federal Reserve keeping interest rates low is obviously necessary. I just don't think the fiscal stimulus has had much effect at all. And to the extent it has had effect, I don't think it's worth the long-term cost.
Okay. Well, I disagree. but I also think that you're talking about it. I was going to point out you're talking about it in terms of blame and in terms of how it looks to people. And that is obviously how people talk about the budget here in Washington. If you aren't Peter Orszag, if you aren't Austin Goolsbee, if you aren't well-versed in this stuff, it is all about perception, which is actually one of the things I wanted to talk about. Was this what I think was a really dumb move by the White House, although we might agree on that, but for different reasons, which is the spending freeze, the so-called
yeah.
spending freeze, which to me seemed like, I would say it's a bad idea implemented poorly. You might think it's a good idea implemented poorly.
That's right. I mean, I think it's a step in the right direction, but it's a little ridiculous when you've increased discretionary spending by in the programs, in the areas that will be affected by the supposed freeze. You increase them by 20% or more, I don't know the exact number, then to say you're freezing them, I mean, we're really consolidating huge run-ups in that spending. And I think where I agree with the left-wing critiques.
I was really wondering what that word was going to wind up being.
of Obama on this, is I do think it gives away a huge amount of rhetorical ground.
Yeah.
This is the Ezra Klein, the Paul Krugman attack on this. Because how can you support even more stimulus spending if, on the other hand, you're saying, no, actually, we need to freeze spending?
And also, they're not really freezing it, as you point out, which just makes him look like a liar. I mean, I think it was a desperate move, and I think it seemed desperate to most people. I think Americans are pretty smart about this stuff, and I think it's not going to – they seem to have abandoned it as a talking point, which –
Yeah, it was weird. It was almost by the time of the State of the Union, everyone left to right had attacked it and realized it was essentially meaningless, so
yeah.
It had kind of lost its force. As a friend of mine on Capitol Hill said, you know, it's the kind of thing, it's so meaningless, you don't float it the day before, because everyone's going to figure out within 24 hours. You do it, you know, the afternoon before,
right.
So it actually has some force still as a talking point, but as you point out, I didn't even have that by the time the State of the Union rolled around.
And speaking of losing rhetorical ground, I actually want to shift to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the hearings that we had this week in Washington at the Senate, and there was some testimony at the House as well. I think I was talking to someone else this morning, and another reporter who asked me if I thought this was a real watershed moment. And I have to say, I think that the testimony of Admiral Mullen and Secretary Gates is an incredibly, defining moment for the gay rights movement, and that the tide is shifted in this very fundamental way, because the people who are for keeping this policy have kind of lost this really significant military, symbol.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly notable that you have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who's calling for overturning this policy, and the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff whose opposition told so significantly back in 93, shifting his position as well, Colin Powell. And it's a clear sign the military brass is not going to resist this the way they did 17 years ago. I still think it's a mistake. I would prefer kind of a watered-down version of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because it's in its original conception, as I understand it, it wasn't meant to exclude gays from the military. It wasn't meant to persecute gays. It was just to ensure that they served with a quiet dignity in keeping with military standards and professionalism. So I liked what Gates floated in terms of let's not, you know, if a third-party tip comes in on someone and someone who has otherwise been serving honorably, why do we follow that up? Why do we investigate them? So I prefer kind of a don't ask, don't tell, don't investigate, where gays can serve, but they do it quietly where their sexual orientation isn't an issue.
I think that that's when you get into the point that Mullen made and made so eloquently, which is the problem with that kind of approach, which is kind of the de facto approach, was the de facto approach for all the years before we had don't ask, don't tell, is that it forces people to lie. And to be secretive about themselves and to worry about being exposed, if not by a third party, then by someone else. And I think that it goes strikes the core of what the military is about, which is about honor and about obeying the law. And I think to have a law on the books that you kind of wink at and you figure out ways to get around, that you officially figure out ways to get around, sends a really complicated and unsettling message about what the military is about.
But if you're not asking and you're not investigating, what would be the occasion for a service member to lie?
Well,
if they just didn't talk about it.
Well, right now they don't talk about it. But the thing is, I think that the law as it's written is once it's found out that they're gay, they have to be discharged.
Right. Well, that's the problem. It is sort of.
So you'd have to lie.
Well, that's a different, slightly different point. The underlying law, you're right, is really at odds with don't ask, don't tell.
Right.
Because the underlying law is a frank and total and outright ban.
Right.
So first, if we're being technical about it, you would have to repeal that, and then we can talk about the modalities.
And but also, we've been in what this I would argue is that you repeal don't ask, don't tell, and then just really strictly enforce rules which are already on the books, which are about fraternization and sort of sexual harassment and sexual behavior, and have that just apply to everybody.
Yeah. I mean, there's a case to be made for that. Certainly, behavior should be more important than status. I worry about a couple things.
You know, there's already people serving, and they don't, like, have, like, parades and stuff, you know, and they don't put glitter
right.
on their uniforms.
It's not like that's
going to change.
Right. I would have two worries. One is just sexual attraction is different than anyone else. It kind of anything else, it affects the dynamic of every relationship if you know it's there or you think it might be there. It affects how you view someone if you think they might be attracted to you. So I think it's a very delicate
thing. It's a good thing we can't see each other right now, Rich. Pardon? It's a good thing we can't see each other right now.
Exactly. Well, you're just making me uncomfortable right now. Just by saying that, you changed the whole dynamic of this conversation. So injecting that into a combat environment, I think, is inherently
a ticklish thing. Have you read much Greek poetry? Because
what's that?
I said, have you read much Greek poetry? Because, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, some attractions, you know, in the past. And there's history of military specifically.
Well, yeah, sure. Maybe as part of Greek culture. But our military does not have that.
And I just think I have more faith in our military than that. I think that they can obey.
They can. I'm just saying it.
They're not subject to the whims of the capricious whims of their attraction. They've spent their life, you know, under discipline and disciplining themselves. I mean, that's what the military is all about. I just think that they can do it. I mean, we have managed to have a very good conversation, even though I assume that you're straight. I mean, you know, I am, but
you're
correct
in your assumption.
Okay. I mean, I didn't want to, you know, this would be an odd time for you to come out if it was true. But we've managed to have this whole conversation, and maybe the dynamic is a little bit weird, but like we're grown-ups and we can handle that. And I think that's it's been happening, and that's what's happening.
But we're not in combat. We're not in a bunker together. Then it would get really weird.
That would get so really, because neither of us, probably neither of us know how to shoot a gun.
I was going to make 2 points, though.
Okay.
One, I think it's there's that inherent difficulty to it. Two, you know, and this is less an argument of principle, more an argument of prudence. Why would you do it now? And certainly if you asked, I imagine if you asked combat NCOs right now, is this another complexity you want to have added to your already incredibly difficult life? They would say no. Now it seems as though this whole change is going to be slow walked, you know, for years. So maybe that objection kind of loses its force as a practical matter. But I don't think this would be the ideal time to do this.
And of course, I would argue with things like the dismissal of all those Arabic translators, like now is the perfect time to do it. And I also think that, again, I have a lot of faith in our fighting men and women. I think the comparison to the integration of the military is not a perfect one, primarily because we already integrated gays and lesbians in the military. Like, there's not going to be, like, you know, we don't have to, there wasn't a separate barracks, you know, that they lived in, and now you're bringing them in. They're already there. But this is one thing that I think is probably going to be similar, which is that Truman thought it was going to take years. He thought that it was going to take years to integrate, successfully racially integrate the army and the entire military because of the same kind of resistance that you're talking about. I mean, almost the same exact language. The discomfort that people would have about working with someone of a different race, you know, whites with blacks mainly, and also the resistance of the people in the front lines. And it wound up taking less than a year. And I think that's a testament to, again, the sort of discipline and honor and willingness to stick to a code that our military has maintained.
Yeah, there's one other point that occurred to me. Oh, as a practical matter, though, when you're kind of talking about this professionalism that would pervade the entire effort, gay and straight soldiers, it would in effect be a version of what the objective of Don't Ask, Don't Tell was in the first place, which is that it's not an issue.
Yeah,
it's not talked about. It's not acknowledged.
It's just not
something that you lie about or tell the truth about. It's just not something that should come up in that environment.
Agreed.
And I do worry a little bit about there is a culture of political correctness in the military. We saw it with Hassan, because he was a Muslim and saying crazy things, everyone kind of wanted to ignore it because who wants to be the guy who's nasty to the Muslim guy in this diverse environment we have. So we'd have to guard very carefully against gay soldiers, in effect, becoming a special category of soldiers with special treatment. Now, I know you wouldn't want that.
I wouldn't, but it's just something to be aware of. I think you're right, but I think that's something that, again, is sort of something that we'd have to be on guard about, but not a reason not to do it. I think again, like, this is going to be a lot like the racial integration of the military, which is that this is going to happen kind of without us noticing so much. Because I think the kind of people, and I mean, in gay and straight, that want to be in the military are actually sort of like you described. They don't want to talk about it. These are not the same people that do the gay pride parades, you know, like that's a really different kind of person.
That's so. Right. I should make my ritualistic objection to the analogy with race. I don't think that entirely holds.
And I agree for lots of different reasons, but I think that idea of the thinking that you're going to have to slow walk it, but winding up not having to, that's where I said that I think there's going to be, that we might see something similar.
Also, just one last point on this, and
sure.
This might drive you crazy, but I really don't think it's been that big a deal. I mean, there have been people who've been treated unfairly, but 11,000 people in the context of a military, well, I've seen 11,000. In the context of a military where since 93, millions of people have circulated in and out, and you have to discount a little bit, for there are people who get in the military and they realize it's not for them and they want to get out. And this is an easy way out, whether you're straight or gay, to announce you're gay.
And I think that should be, it would be great to be able to get rid of that as an excuse.
That would be an upside. Again, we're talking about a very small
Yeah, you know,
the military does not rise or fall on this issue one way or the other.
No, but I think, again, to go back to what Avril Mullen said, I think it's a matter of honor and integrity. And I think that kind of thing doesn't matter about how many people are affected. I mean, I would say the same thing about torture. It doesn't even matter if it only happens a few times, you know. Like, I think it's just wrong, you know. So we should...
Most gays in the military are serving with honor, even if they don't announce they're gay.
Yep,
I don't know why there's an obligation to say, I'm not just a soldier, I'm a gay soldier.
You know,
that's the only way I can be honest. I mean, that sort of shows.
What I think is going to happen is that you're not going to get that. You're just going to get people being able to that fear will go away. There's not going to be National Coming Out Day in the Army.
Right, but why is it so important for them
because they fear every day that it could happen.
Okay, well then let's not investigate.
Okay, then we're going to do the integrity issue. Then we have a law on the books that everyone is willfully ignoring.
That's another issue. But why is it dishonest for someone to serve in the who's gay to serve in the military without talking about how they're gay? Why is that? I mean,
because we all have aspects of our lives we don't talk about. Right now on the books, if they're found to be gay, they must be discharged.
Right. Well, that's the underlying law.
Right. And so I think actually we're both in agreement, sort of. Right?
I would agree.
Like,
on
we need to repeal that law.
I would agree on repealing that law.
Yay! Yay! So now, actually, I'm going to keep hammering on you. Let's go directly to that Daily Coast poll, because we might agree on. Actually, this won't be me mocking you or Republicans in general. You know the poll I'm talking about.
I do. Go ahead. Start agreeing with me. Start the conversation with your agreement, even before you know what I'm going to say.
Well, I don't know.
You really think I'm that predictable, don't you?
Well, most humans are. My dad's an actuary, and it turns out that really you can predict what most people will do most of the time, but not you specifically.
That's the wonder of insurance.
Yes. What I would presume, what I would hope that you would object to, but I won't predict that you're going to object to, is the fact that many of these questions were designed to elicit embarrassing answers.
Really?
Yes.
You're right. I agree with that.
Ah, yay! So was that something that you were going to say?
Yeah. You know, I mean, this obviously was a very clever effort, and especially clever because Coase can just say, gosh, what can you object to? These are just questions, you know, just straightforwardly.
And it's a reputable firm that did it, but it's not a reputable firm that designed it. I mean, it is a reputable firm, but they didn't design the questions.
Yeah, I would say a couple things. One, I mean, when we're talking about extremism and you're going to do a survey highlighting the extremism of the other side, when you're working on a book called American Taliban, which in your own words catalogs the ways in which modern-day conservatives share the same agenda as radical jihadists in the Islamic world, well, I mean, who's the extremist here? I mean, that is obviously ridiculous.
Yeah.
And now some of these answers are...
I'm looking at it right now, actually.
So you agreed Coase is an extremist.
I don't know if he personally is an extremist. I think that's an incredibly inflammatory thing to say.
But you don't think it's extremist. In my mind, only extremist says the other side in the American political discussion shares the same agenda as radical jihadists.
Okay, that's pretty extreme.
So Coase is an extremist.
But that statement actually,
yes,
and not
yes.
also, no,
he's
I will
not.
Say
he
that,
just says very extreme things.
I do.
He's
I
just
think
writing an extreme book, but he's not an extremist.
I think it's important to separate people's rhetoric with their actions. Which is why I have probably said some very mean things about people over the years and probably said some politically extreme things, but I don't think I've ever done, not ever, but I think that on the whole, the actions that I've taken in my life are not extreme. And I think that when I look at Marcos's political beliefs and the actions that he's taken, he is definitely to the left of me and to the far left of me probably, which is not a lot of room there, but he's there. But I don't know enough about his personal beliefs to call him an extremist. That is an incredibly inflammatory thing for him to say.
But he's writing an entire book about it. He's not embarrassed by it. It's not. We all say things that are too mean or too nasty or embarrassing in retrospect.
Like Ann Coulter, right? Would you call Ann Coulter an extremist?
Says extreme things. Yeah, she says extreme things.
So you're making the same distinction that I am.
Yeah, maybe. maybe.
Because she wants to get attention. She wants to start a discussion, right?
Yeah, but so, I think it's incredibly hypocritical of Coase to commission this poll where he's highlighting the extreme views of the other side when he himself is writing a book that's extreme.
I don't think that that's hypocritical because he's not saying that extremism in general is bad. He's saying extremism in this direction is bad.
Right. His own, of course, I mean, that's what all extremists think. Their own extremism is fine.
That's right.
Extremism
so
in defense of liberty or progressivism or expansion of the state or whatever it is.
Right.
But, I mean, to share the agenda of radical jihadists, you'd want to have to establish a caliphate, Islamic caliphate, around the world and behead everyone who disagrees with you
and
have women wear burqas.
And he's going to find cases where you have extreme, you know, I'm sure he's going to have examples of cases when people have taken their religion a little too far. Well, or too far, way too far, perhaps. I'm sure he'll have examples because those examples exist because we are basically a free country and we mostly let people do what they want until they do something so bad or so extreme then we notice it.
I know, but it's not as though
And also, I want to get back to
Bin Laden has taken his religion a little too far. I mean,
but the thing is, like, let's go back to the Ann Coulter comparison because I really think that's a good one. I think that this book is written probably to sell copies, and also to get a lot of attention. And that's also we are talking about the poll, which did paint Republicans in it was designed to paint Republicans, you know, mainstream Republicans, in incredibly bad light.
Of course.
I actually want to use an example in case people don't know what we're talking about. There is a question that says, do you think that should public school students be taught that the book of Genesis in the Bible explains how God created the world? Now, that's 77% yes. But you know what? That question, you could take that any number of ways, right?
I didn't see that one.
Well, it's should public school students be taught the book of Genesis in the Bible explains how God created the world.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, you could
interpret
someone,
that question.
Right. Someone could answer that just thinking, should they know about the book of Genesis?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Or should they be taught that there was a beginning of the world? You know, it was clearly designed to get the most number of people possible saying yes.
And you also have to realize that just random people in the public, right, left, in between, tend to be incredibly ill-informed. You know, most of them don't know who the Speaker of the House is. So that you're going to get some of them to say things that sound wacky doesn't really tell us very much.
Yeah.
You know, there's a question about whether Obama should be impeached, and, you know, almost 40% of people say yes. But where is the actual respectable expression of that sentiment, if
right.
it is really so widespread? Where is the respectable blogger anywhere on the right? Now, that's a challenge, and someone's going to go find him, probably, who thinks Obama should be impeached.
But, yeah, right. And also, like, another question that I think was designed badly or designed well, depending on what answer you want, do you believe Acorn stole the 2008 election, which has a yes, 21%, no, 24%, and a not sure, 55%. And people have been taking that not sure as like, wow, they're not sure if
right.
Acorn stole the election.
Most of them probably haven't even heard of Acorn.
Yeah, that would be, you would answer not sure because you don't know what it means to steal an election. You've never heard of Acorn. There's a lot of reasons why you would answer not sure to that question. So, you know, I think that
you're on a roll. I'm agreeing with everything you say. Just keep going.
Now, I'll say all that, and then I'll say I think the Tea Party movement is the biggest gift that Democrats will get for 2010 that they can imagine. That is the gift the Republicans can give.
No, I can't agree on that. Actually, in the latest issue of National Review, my colleagues Ramesh Panuru and Kate O'Byrne, they write about another public opinion survey that the National Review Institute did, which Kate heads. And what they found, which I thought was interesting, was basically these Tea Party activists, they're just conservatives who are particularly active and are particularly motivated by fiscal conservative issues. I thought there might be some more Perot sentiment in there where they're not so socially conservative and they're motivated by fiscal issues and a paranoid hatred of the establishment, but they're really just conservatives. And Jonathan Martin had a great piece in the Politico about how all the commentary about how the Tea Party movement was going to split the Republican Party and destroy Republican chances in 2010 because of that contentious congressional race up in New York 23 just hasn't been borne out. You know, the Tea Party people were excited about this pro-choice candidate in Massachusetts named Scott Brown.
Right.
Because he's as conservative as you plausibly can get and still win in Massachusetts. So that shows a very practical attitude and a flexible attitude. In Illinois, you had a bunch of much more conservative candidates than Mark Kirk, the congressman who won the Illinois Senate primary. Well, guess what? Mark Kirk is more established,
but he also
more
didn't
moderate,
get the Tea Party support. But Mark Kirk did not get the Tea Party support.
Right, but what did it matter? He still won.
Right. Well, it matters if you're going to talk about the Tea Party movement. And I want to say I look forward to reading that article and looking at the numbers because I believe you and I want to find out more. I think that when I say the Tea Party movement is a gift to Democrats, it is not that it is in the primary races where it might be a gift. And also it's the perception, obviously, that I think you're right. I mean, if you go to one of these events and you talk to people, which I have done a lot of, you will find some crazy people. They're there. But, you know, there's a lot of people from the suburbs who, you know, bring their kids and are just interested and aware. And I'm sure that's sort of the person you're talking about. And I wouldn't call that person a Tea Party person. But the thing is, these movements do tend to get hijacked, right, by the craziest people. And also, I don't think it's a good thing when you have Glenn Beck saying the nutty stuff that he says and claiming and sort of being the metaphorical head of this movement. Metaphorical head? I don't know. I guess all heads are metaphorical in that way, but anyway, Glenn Beck, crazy, bad. I don't think people want people like him in public office.
Yeah, that's why he's not running for office.
Right.
And this is something last year there was that period where there was this intense debate over Rush Limbaugh, and is he the leader of the Republican Party? And you had some conservative blogger saying, you know, we'll never have a conservative future again in this country as long as Rush Limbaugh is so high profile. Well, he's not on the ballot anywhere. You know,
no,
you have Bob McDonnell in the ballot in Virginia, and Chris Christie in New Jersey, and Scott Brown in Massachusetts. They are politicians who people actually vote for.
And the more that Democrats can link whoever is on the ballot with Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck.
It doesn't work, though. I mean, it doesn't work. Because look at Bob McDonnell or Scott Brown.
Well, it didn't
as
work
examples.
In those cases. I would say...
These are guys that they have their own people, and you can't morph them into a talk show host, especially when they have a record there. You know, Bob McDonnell was 18 years in the state legislature. So you can try to call him George W. Bush or Rush Limbaugh, all this stuff. It doesn't work if he has his own record and his own established persona. So I think Democrats have really fooled themselves about the Rush card and how useful it can be. And now it's kind of morphed a little bit into the Tea Party card. But you can call someone like Mark Kirk a name or Bob McDonnell or Scott Brown. They tried it with Brown. He's a Tea Party candidate. Well, for most people, one, this goes back to most people not paying attention to the level we do. They don't know what that means to supposedly be a Tea Party candidate. Two, I think most people have, you know, to the extent they know something about the Tea Party and they're not partisan Democrats, they kind of have somewhat favorable views about it. And three, the candidate, whoever he is, unless he's actually the head of a Tea Party movement somewhere or organization somewhere, is going to be his own person. So it's not going to work. I mean, I hope Democrats keep thinking it will work.
The only place it really can help Democrats is obviously in the primaries, to hope for really fractious primaries. And that's what Republicans hope for Democrats as well. I think you're right. The lesson of Bob McDonald is a really good one. That is exactly what they tried to do. They tried to make McDonald seem like an extremist. And because he's so visibly not, and because people knew him, you know, it took a while for Deeds to be able. He never successfully, you know, got himself out there.
Yeah.
So.
But this is my big take on what's going on in our politics now.
It's
the economy.
I'll take notes.
The economy is important, but it's not the main thing. the main event, and, you know, poor Democratic candidates, you know, candidates matter, Deeds and Coakley, Corzine for that matter, weren't so great in the races that have mattered most in recent months. But the big story is the Democratic agenda. People do not like the domestic agenda. They're scared by it. They think it's going too far, too fast. It's spending too much. And unless that reverses, no other cute maneuver is going to save the Democrats. They have to move to the middle because the 2008 election was not a mandate for a lurch to the left. Obama sounded very moderate in 2008. He has a great genius for seeming reasonable in any public presentation, and people wanted to give him a chance. It was not a mandate for a lurch to the left.
He is not really – I mean, okay, what would you – his great – you would say his great lurches to the left are
– the stimulus. He might not have gotten elected if he said immediately upon taking office, I'm going to pass – $787 billion, now it's even more.
But the stimulus, I mean, when you're talking about the budget, the stimulus, you can make an economic argument that we wouldn't be getting better if it weren't for the stimulus, and we do need a second stimulus.
Well,
now, I think if I can just respond to your larger point, I think that you're right that people are frustrated and that the spending alarms them. That is just true. I don't think that you can look at polling and talk to people and not get that message. I don't think that this is a right-left issue necessarily, because if you look at other kinds of polling, especially about insurance and healthcare, people really liked the public option. If you explained it to, if you didn't call it the public option and you explained that sort of its key pillars, it actually winds up getting not a huge majority of support, but like 60-70% in multiple polls. And I don't think that and also we're the only country, only industrialized country in the world that considers socialized medicine a lurch to the left.
Yeah, that's why we're America.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just we have always been have a more limited government and more kind of free market attitude.
But I just want to say that like I don't so and also as someone who is left of the president myself, like I don't see him lurching my way.
Well, I know that's a product of your perspective, which even though it's a great perspective, Anna, and even though you've been so reasonable during this conversation, I don't think most people necessarily share. I mean, it's basically a center-right country. And a point I was going to make about the stimulus, we can argue about the economic merits, but I believe in that last, I believe it was the last presidential debate, Obama says, you know what we're going to have to do because of this recession? We're going to have to cut back. And I'm going to go line by line through the budget, cutting wasteful spending, and tell you what, my plan is a net cut in spending for the federal government. If he had said instead, you know what, we need almost $1 trillion in deficit spending within weeks. That would have been a big deal, and it would not have been popular. And that's why he didn't say it.
He also
ran against a radical overhaul of the insurance system. He ran against the individual mandate. He ran against the Cadillac tax.
No, I agree. No, he ran against all that stuff. He had one of the most moderate healthcare proposals of the Democratic, bench. What I'm really trying to say is I think you're right. People are alarmed about spending, but also at the same time, they're alarmed about like not having health care and knowing that our health care system is broken.
Well, I'd say a couple
things. As a person who lives in a 100% unemployed household right now, I can tell you that I'm worried about it.
Right.
It's been
a practical matter.
But, you know, I want whatever needs to be done to get us to get the economy going again. And if you can convince me that it's a stimulus package, and I guess I buy that economic argument, I'm not so upset about it.
I would say a couple things. One, on just the politics of healthcare as a practical matter, you know what, like 80-85% of people have health insurance. And what they really want is for it to be cheaper. Because, I mean, that's probably the thing that's done most to
and less complicated, and not as just as big a fucking headache as it is.
Sure.
I hate not having health insurance, but I also it sucked having to do what I had to do when I had it.
But instead, the Democrats have undertaken this huge effort that actually I would think there's argument about this, but seems pretty persuasive of the evidence that it's going to increase the premiums for people who already have insurance, and it will help the uninsured. And you know that's an important goal, but it's not necessarily one that motivates the average voter out there who has more. The nasty word for it is more selfish concerns.
Right.
That's where
you try to sweeten the deal with the reforms on insurance. Which but again, all...
those they're really the insurance reforms also are at least the biggest one. You know, being able to get insurance when you have a pre-existing condition is more of a matter for people again who don't have insurance.
And actually, it's an actuarial impossibility to make that work without having a mandatory.
See, now that, and that's a key point. And you know, we've heard a lot of loose talk. Since Massachusetts will do a minimal deal, we'll do the thing that's most popular, which is the no longer excluding people with pre-existing conditions. But as you point out, if you do that, it creates this you know, the ball starts rolling down the hill and becomes a huge boulder and then eventually an avalanche because you have to mandate
people get insurance.
You just
don't have it. If I can switch your metaphor, you're basically not spreading the risk thin enough. You have to have a really, really large group of people to take that amount of risk and spread it, you know, thinly throughout them. Do you know what I mean?
Well, the problem, as I understand it, is if you can get insurance when you're sick, everyone will wait to get insurance until they're sick. And then you have to mandate that they get insurance to avoid that adverse selection problem. And then if they don't get insurance, you have to fine them, which is unpopular. You have to define what insurance is. And that politically, we've seen it in states that have these sort of mandates. Then you get all sorts of benefits that some people may not necessarily need, piled on top of the insurance, which makes it more expensive. Then you have to subsidize people so they can get insurance. And then because of the subsidies, you have to do huge cuts in Medicare and you have to raise taxes. And if you put that all together, you started with something that's very popular and you ended up with a package which is extremely unpopular.
And it would be just so much easier just to nationalize the entire system.
Okay, good luck with that. That also would be a move to the center.
I want to explain actuarially why that doesn't work, because it your vision, it's so funny because like it's a conservative vision, like you're thinking of all the
funny
different
how that works
government impositions that might happen if you institute this one law. There's a much simpler explanation about why it won't work. If you think of a group of people who all have pre-existing conditions and you think about a way to visualize the amount of risk, they have a lot of risk in their lives, right? So they're each carrying like a pound of butter that represents a pound of risk, right? And the way that insurance works is that you get a lot of people to come together and you share that burden of risk. So if you create a pool that's only people that are high risk.
So what's happening to the butter? Is the butter being thrown in the pool?
I shouldn't
use sugar,
butter.
Some flour here?
You can make cookies.
Exactly.
But I mean, do you understand what I mean? Like why actuarially it won't work?
Oh, I agree with you. It won't work.
I mean, but there's reasons, like, before you get into anything that you said. There's just number reasons why it won't work. Like, because you can't spread the risk thin enough.
Because you just have sick people.
Yes. That's probably the simpler way to say it.
Well, we agree it won't work. And it will...
It won't work unless you figure out some way, unless you have some kind of mandatory coverage.
I want to go back to one thing you said about the public option. I thought it was so interesting. You're right. Public option did not poll badly at all. I mean, it depended on how you asked the question.
Yeah.
But it's so funny how that became such a radioactive symbol for both sides.
Yeah.
When I think for the general public, it wasn't what was most problematic about
no,
the
I think
bill.
That's exactly right. And it was a tear your hair out frustration, I think, for a lot of us that supported the public option. Because it was so you, I just wanted to take these polls and show it. I was like, don't you read this stuff, guys? Like, show it to senators. You're right. It became like this politically toxic thing that we in the media also treated as a politically toxic thing. You
it's
know?
A symbol. It's always easier to talk about symbols.
We would just report on it as though that we took the perception that the public option was toxic and talked about the public option as though it were toxic, which is why when you polled people and asked about something that's called a public option, they said they didn't like it. But when you asked them about the specific things that were in it, they wound up liking
it. The other thing that's been amazing to me about the healthcare debate and something you wouldn't have predicted going in is that you have liberal Democrats so on board and so fine and the AARP totally fine with what in any other circumstance would be considered pretty severe cuts to Medicare. And this is a suggestion that I made tongue-in-cheek the other day because I know it would never happen. But if Obama is suddenly so concerned about the deficit and out-of-control spending, well, here he has about $500 billion, $400 billion that supposedly is easy, it's painless. Liberal Democrats are in favor, so just do the Medicare cuts. Can we agree about that?
Yeah,
cutting Medicare is a good idea. I've always, you know, thought the program needed reform, and now you guys are fine with it too. So that should be maybe we can end on this bipartisan note in favor of those Medicare cuts.
I'm not in favor of the Medicare cuts. I actually think that the easiest way to solve the healthcare debate would be just to expand Medicare to everyone. But that would be not ending on a bipartisan note. But let's find out. So can we end on something? Can we agree on something? I also love snow.
Yeah, say something reasonable again, and I'll agree with it.
Okay. Let's say something reasonable. Why don't you say something reasonable, and I'll agree with it.
That's not my job description.
Well, neither of us have the job description of agreeing with each other.
Now, are you a snow person?
I said I love snow.
You're like, okay.
What I like is the side effects of snow. So, like, after we get done with this, I'm going to go build a fire. All of our pets are going to sit around. We'll make some
cozy
mulled wine. It'll be awesome.
Very cozy. The problem with New York is the snow is great when it's falling and the city becomes quieter and much more intimate than it ever is. Yeah, and the lights on the snow, it's really gorgeous. But almost immediately, you know, it's all churned up and turned into gray slush. And then for weeks afterwards, whenever you're crossing a street, there are these huge kind of icy puddles. So it's beautiful when it happens, but it's ruined very quickly.
I think I have a bipartisan note we can end on. The thing you have just described, the Obama presidency.
It was beautiful at the inception.
Yes, it was.
And now it's a slushy mess.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, Anna.
All right.
Have a great weekend.
You too.